I think that the past social movements are the precursors to the social movements that we are living through. I'll give you three or four quick examples. They're a pretty good platform for what I think. Take number one, fair trade instead of corporate-led trade, right? You have this combination of the Seattle young people, environmentalists, anarchists, creative direct action people, with the older elements of the organized labor movement. That labor movement that led the general strike of the 1930s in Seattle. Enough memory there to decide to go with what they call the kids in the streets. And, you know, it's not everything, but it's not every day either that you shut down an organization, a secret organization representing 150 countries dominated by the G7, and put them out of business or cripple their ability to function for 7 years, which is the aftershock of Seattle. And it gives a sense that the social movements of the past have something in common with the social movements of the present, and some of the answers of the past can be blended into new answers. The extension of the better part of the New Deal to the whole world, instead of the Reagan idea of dismantling it, is a good start. The New Deal plus environmentalism, yes, plus farm workers, which were left out of the New Deal. But the New Deal is a core idea from the past, which can flow into the future, and without the New Deal experience, we would be more impoverished in trying to imagine what our demands are. Secondly, environmental restoration, including global warming. I hate the word global warming, but because I always wonder about global suffering. But environmental restoration, I'm not talking about mitigation or environmental impact reports or all the superficial reforms that came with the deeper reforms. I'm talking about starting with Kyoto and the biodiversity treaties, the growing power of citizens and governments to begin to control corporate and state behavior on an enforceable basis. Again, at the forefront of this movement are people of color and the poor, but also the younger generation, but also people like Al Gore, who should have no business becoming more radical in old age. He's supposed to be going the other way. So, again, the continuity there of social movements is what I'm trying to draw your attention to. Similarly, number three, human rights mechanisms that prevail over states and corporations. How the hell did you get from 73, the ITT, Kissinger, Nixon, Pinochet destruction of the Chilean left, the trade unions, the activists, the decapitating of all those people, the artists, their hands being cut off. I bought into the idea that there was something known as a dictatorship. I don't believe that anymore. I believe there are people with dictatorial tendencies, but it's clear that the dictatorship did not prevail. The social movements in time prevailed. And one of the interesting things happened is that Latin America started to move on a continental basis away from dictatorship towards democratic institutions, towards elections, and ideas like human rights were hammered out and defined and refined in the furnace of struggles in places like Chile. And they found their way into the global climate. They became cultural norms first. You don't pay taxes for torture. You don't violate human rights wantonly and cruelly. They found their way from there into law that was enforceable, into the hands of European judges that tracked down Pinochet while he was shopping in Piccadilly and put him into a miserable situation that led not only to the end of the dictatorship, but to a whole lot of people being held accountable in Chile for the era of the Pinochet regime. And that is still going on. You have a president of Chile elected. Howard Zinn, remember this. Elected. Who herself was tortured. A mom, a single mom, tortured. Her father executed by the very people who she's putting on the trial of accountability today. And so on, in Bolivia, in Argentina, in Brazil. It's not all the same, it's not all exact, but it's an example of how these processes seem to grow over time. You have, I think it starts with how Amnesty International actually started. And then the idea of human rights found its way into Carter's foreign policy. And from there, it found its way into these other mechanisms. And it's not going to be reversed. It can be undercut, it can be limited, but it can't be reversed. Fourth, let me cite Senator Feingold's vote against the Patriot Act. I believe he was the only person that voted against the Patriot Act. I don't even know what I would have done. Brave act. Good man. What if he was from Kansas? I think he could vote that way because the good people of Madison, the good people of Wisconsin, made it possible for him to be able to vote that way. It's not that he's an automaton and goes with the prevailing winds, but the progressive tradition and the progressive climate in parts of Wisconsin, I too am from this area, Oconomowoc, 50 cousins, I'm not an outside interloper here. I know from where I speak, most of my cousins probably voted against him the first time around. But it's Wisconsin that made a fine goal possible. It's not the other way around. And I think that I should end with a word about Iraq. Most of my time these days is Iraq, 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 Iraq. I read, I research, I write. I'm a rank and file relic in the university and in the anti-war movement. That's all I do. But it's a very interesting example of what I'm saying. There was a recent study at Indiana University of about 1,000 interviews of street demonstrators against the war in Iraq in 07 and 06. And they said, if you define the anti-war movement narrowly as the people that go to national demonstrations, they said that the anti-war movement is built on two what we call cohorts. And they are the young and the old. The young is 18 to 27 with a peak age of 23. The old is the 46 to 67 year olds, that would be me, with a peak age of 54. So you have a blending, you can see it in the streets, you have a blending of the Vietnam generation with the Iraq generation, learning from each other, marching together, but it's not been broken. We don't have an experience of McCarthyism that ruptured the continuity of the progressive and radical tradition. We have one tradition that rises on the shoulders of the previous and opens new pathways and new doors. Now I can hear the ghost of my Lord Appleman Williams, and maybe some of you, refusing to accept this thesis. But here it is. Americans have been forced by this war to awaken on 10 occasions. Over 100,000 people have marched in the streets. Three of those occasions were 300,000 to 500,000. Public opinion has concluded that this war is a mistake more rapidly than the public did during Vietnam, according to Gallup polls. 200 cities have passed resolutions or voter referendums calling for withdrawal. Arguably, the Howard Dean campaign of 2003-2004 was the McCarthy campaign reborn on a larger scale, especially financially. Groups like MoveOn and the internet community, the blogging community, actually raised, I wrote this in this book, and I had to recheck it right up to the final 10 seconds before it went to printer because I was sure I was wrong. They raised $180 million for candidates in the 03-04 cycle. It's unheard of. There's never been funding like that for peace candidates of any definition. Unheard of. Here's how you get that number. $50 million straight out of MoveOn. Another $130 million you can get by cross-checking MoveOn membership with federal contributors who have to be listed, thanks to disclosures brought about by the 1960s campaign reform movement. So $180 million, more than we would ever know what to do with. I submit it as a fact, as I'm trying to build the case that there is, in fact, this anti-war phenomenon. I don't know where you fit Michael Moore. Is he a radical? Is he an insider? What is the guy? I should know. I'm from Michigan, too. But I do know this, that he took documentaries from the black and white grainy stuff of newsreel in the 60s to the biggest box office hits, Fahrenheit 9/11, in the history of documentaries. He even redefined what documentary is. That is a measure of the public awareness built by social movements and their various advocates and activists in this time. And I never forget, because one of them has a kid at my kid's school, the Dixie Chicks, straight out of Texas, they were supposed to be wiped out, eliminated by country music buffoon industrial bureaucrats. And as far as I can tell, I still listen to their tapes. They seem to be doing well. They win Emmys. And they're not ready to make nice with Bush. That's what I'm really saying. So you have this culminating in this 2006 election. Right? Now, there can be many explanations of an election, but the primary explanation of 06 was Iraq. This is a gerrymandered Congress. I know it well, because I do gerrymandering. I did it for a living, right? That's what you do. That's what politics is all about. State legislators draw districts for Congress members. So you try to make it impossible for any incumbent to ever be defeated. I remember in California, we sent a mad anti-environmental person off to Washington to get rid of him because we thought the Democrats had control of Washington. He was a Tom DeLay type. And even he was defeated in 06 by bloggers and local activists who were fed up with Bush and the war in Iraq. He was defeated in a agricultural pesticide-laden congressional district, and he's not coming back. And it's a good thing, because under the Republicans in Washington, he went to be the chairman of the subcommittee that was trying to repeal the Endangered Species Act. Very bad move on our part in California, but we made up for it. So that 06 was a historic phenomenon. I don't believe it's ever happened that American voters have voted against a war and voted a Congress out in the midst of a war in progress. But of course, that's mere electoral politics. I know I can hear Appleman Williams and a lot of you probably refusing to believe these facts. And the reason for that, I think, is because of the hundreds of thousands of deaths and the millions of cases of suffering that have been caused, the cause of bringing about this modest raise in the raising of the American consciousness, right? It's not enough to say that you're winning political victories when people are still dying by the hundreds of thousands. I know that. And I find it very important to find a way to feel the weight of all that suffering every day as I go about my very modest business of researching and writing and teaching and protesting. I know all about, more than I ever want to know, about the secret assassination teams, the secret dirty war, the violations of the Leahy Amendment, the fact that it could get worse, that Giuliani is advised by Norman Podhoretz, who is the godfather of the neoconservatives who've devoted themselves to not only this war, but have devoted themselves since the 1960s to ending the New Left by any and all means. I know that Hillary Clinton and her tail, Barack Obama, have both committed themselves to an outrageous proposal to end the war in 4 years, written by a think tank in Washington, D.C. And I know that at any moment, including this moment, the bombing of Iraq can extend to the bombing of Iran, and we would find out about it 24 hours later.
I know all that. The difference for me is that knowing these things makes me feel stronger. I think that that's because I've been here before. If it wasn't for the 60s, I couldn't bear this war. But I know the 60s. I know this war. I know the pattern. It makes me stronger. It could be because I'm just a nonconformist. It could be because I'm a misfit. But I know this. I know that we're up against a Machiavellian Goliath claiming to be the number one superpower in the world. Why would it be easy to deal Goliath a setback? Why would it be a short task? Why would it take a short time? Does anybody seriously believe that you can summon all of us in this room enough moral urgency to blow Goliath over or blow a pragmatic incumbent out of office? Not easy. Almost impossible. But certainly more moral exhortation isn't going to do it. I think if you look at it from Bush's perspective for a moment, you may feel why I get a certain satisfaction as a kind of warrior. Bush has got problems. I have to tell myself this every day. 80% of all Iraqis demanding the withdrawal of American troops within a year. 60% of Iraqis justifying the right of armed self-defense or armed attack on foreign occupiers. 144 members of the Iraqi parliament signing a petition calling for U.S. withdrawal. No more Rumsfeld. No more Wolfowitz. No more Libby. No more Gonzalez. Republicans jumping ship. No victory in sight for them either. No exit strategy. Not in Iraq. Not in Afghanistan. Not in the war on terrorism. It's a nightmare for them. If it is for us, it's a great nightmare for them. Because they, in a way, have more to lose. In fact, they're just fighting to avoid losing. They're not fighting to win anything. So I think we're in that stage, and I think it would be very wrong to paraphrase Appleman Williams to dismiss ending the war in Iraq and driving Bush and the neoconservatives out of office as just another occasional dramatic victory that will leave the power structure for future imperial wars as strong as ever. I don't think so. That's not what the Pentagon thinks. That's not what the CIA thinks. That's not what the Republican Party thinks. They feel that their dramatic project for the Middle East has been given a severe setback. They feel discredited. They feel that their ranks are dividing, are splitting. They feel that it's not going well. They feel they are going to lose the presidency. They feel they're going to lose more members of Congress. So seen from their perspective, as well as ours, it seems to me the balance of forces has to be said to be shifting. And yes, this ending the war is not going to end imperialism. It's not going to end the power structure. But it's going to create breathing space. It's going to create an opportunity, if we seize the opportunity, to argue about other approaches to our domestic and foreign policy priorities. I think they spent 20 years trying to get rid of the Vietnam syndrome. What was the matter with the Vietnam syndrome? They made it sound like it was a mental illness, you know, a syndrome, right? As I recall, the Vietnam syndrome, before it was called that, was no more Vietnams, no more policing the world, no more imperial presidencies, reconcile with your enemies, bring back the draft resistors from Canada, normalize relationships with Vietnam. That was the syndrome. I guess they thought that that syndrome, if it sunk deeply into our nervous systems, would prevent us from aggressive wars. Yes, that's the idea. And that's why Bush 1 said after the Persian Gulf War, by God, we have defeated the Vietnam syndrome. I felt I was out of my mind. What is this man raving about? I'd forgotten that that was his intent. I thought it was about something else. People were talking about, it must be about oil. No, not just oil. It was the elimination of opposition tendencies.
And when you think about the fact that everything has been designed to make this war touch us as little as possible, you should feel good. Yeah, the campuses are apathetic. That's because there's no draft. You want the draft? I don't. Fought too hard to eliminate that totalitarian thing. But if there was a draft, of course, there'd be riots all over the country. They eliminated the draft. They gave the students the right to vote. They eliminated direct taxation. They made it supplemental appropriations. That's what I meant about the feeling that you're in a sealed room where your shouts can't even be heard. So I think that this war will end. And I'll tell you in just a brief summary of how. Wars require foundations. They're not very long affairs, horrible affairs. But they require what I call pillars. There are certain pillars you have to have. And when there's enough people pressure on the pillars of this war in Iraq, the war will end. Not before. We're getting there. It may be a long struggle. But keep your eye on the pillar, not on the presidential candidates. What are we talking about? The pillar of public opinion is absolutely essential, including political parties, media, but public opinion as a whole. You've got to convince the undecided, you've got to convince the people who think it was a mistake to get in, and maybe it's a mistake to get out. You've got to convince them that compounding the mistake, that sending good money after bad, sending more blood after blood wasted is a bigger mistake, is catastrophic. You've got to argue the case. You cannot push them or force them to accept it. It has to be argued. And I'll tell you this. Those congressional districts and states that are close to peace movement, the peace bloc, has a huge fractional difference, a role to play in defeating people or in electing people every 2 years. Secondly, the pillar that I think is quite crucial is, obviously, you have to have troops. Endless numbers of recruits and more troops and more troops. The draft, which we ended, serves as a break on their ability to acquire troops. They've got themselves all tied up in knots. So if you want to put your people pressure on the pillar of recruitment, the nearest high school or community college campus is the place to be. Getting in the face of the recruiters, arguing with the recruiters, giving the kids an option, talking to their parents, mobilizing them. I've seen high schools in East L.A. lose 50% of their average turnout of ROTC cadets since 2004, just in a two-year period. In fact, some of the recruiters, this is hilarious, some of the recruiters are AWOL. They can't stand their jobs. There's about five of them that are being searched for by the Pentagon. Where did you go? Think of the troops as not necessarily against us. They're doing their horrible job. But if you look at the polls of the troops on the ground, it's about the same as the home front. 25% for immediate withdrawal, another 30% for withdrawal in a year, about 55-60% for getting out. And most of them, if you ask them, why are you fighting? They're fighting to protect their own buddies. They're fighting to protect their lives. They're fighting to get home. They're not fighting for a cause. And so the issue of supporting dissenters within the military, the right of people like Aaron Watada to stand up and speak their conscience, the fight against military recruiters, these are fights where you're putting your pressure on that pillar. And the third pillar that I think is going down is the money. You have to have infinite amount of money. You have to make up a figure and then double it every year. You remember, it's going to be $200 billion now that Bush is asking for. Previously, it was $150, but they found a need for another $50. There's a reason the money demand always goes up, because every soldier wounded costs more money. Every tank disabled, every APC disabled costs more money. Replacement costs. So it's an inflationary spiral that cannot possibly be stopped. And when you get to asking for a couple hundred billion a year every January, and you're getting to an election year, then, of course, it becomes harder on the politicians if public opinion is already against the war. And what I would suggest is you go to www.costofwar, you get that here, and You'll find, I checked it last night up to the second, about midnight or 1 a.m. Taxpayers in Wisconsin last night had spent $7.3 billion on the Iraq War, and that amount of money could have paid for health insurance for 4.3 million kids, salaries of 127,299 public school teachers, or sent 356,096 young people to the universities on free four-year scholarships. That would be a peace dividend worth fighting for. It would be more than you would need, right? So to end the war, the pillar of the budget has to be confronted, and the peace movement can't be alone. The peace movement has got to be linked with labor, with seniors, with veterans groups, with housing groups, with inner city groups who feel, with the Katrina survivors, who feel that the war is taking money from their needs. It's that simple. So that's basically it. If those pressures are sufficient, they will be sufficient to make any president give up on the war in Iraq when they no longer have those pillars to lean on. Deny them public opinion, deny them troops, and deny them budget. And you have denied them what they need for their survival and continuation. Now, I've said several times how old I am, but there's a reason for that. I figured out on the way over here that I'm 25% the age of the United States. I've lived almost lived through 30 years of the history of this young United States. And sometimes I feel I'm very close to that history. My ancestors buried not far from here. You know, were forced out of Ireland into graveyards in places like Sullivan and Oconomowoc. But I also feel the more I experience that I am actually part of a 500-year history. I've only lived through 10% of the 500 years. But the good news I feel is that the 500 years are coming to an end. It may not be in my lifetime, but it's not going to be another 500 years. I'm talking about the issues of colonialism, conquest, slavery, the Inquisition, and the Crusades. Colonialism, conquest, Crusades, slavery, Inquisition. All 500 or 600 years. We're living through not the death rattle of the 60s, we're living through the death rattle of colonialism, conquest, Crusades, slavery, and the Inquisition. More people will have to die. More years will have to be spent. But if you see it as being born and raised in part of something that's already been going on 500 years, and you visit places where the original people are still fighting, it's not asking too much to give a few hours of every day to try to end something that has caused so much suffering for so many centuries. I found something that Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers Schuller, I believe, probably from a book of the Buells, who looked back on the women's right to vote, that I'll close with by reading to put it in perspective, because I think it sums everything up. Hundreds of women gave the accumulated possibilities of an entire lifetime. Thousands gave years of their lives, gave constant interest, and such aid as they could. It was a continuous, seemingly endless chain of activity. Young suffragists who helped forge the last links of that chain were not even born when it began. Old suffragists who forged the first links were dead when it ended. But it did end, and this war will end. Thank you.
We can take a little time for questions. We have to be out of the building at 9:30, however. So we have microphones there and there. So maybe, what do you say, 10 minutes?
We have 25 minutes.
25? Okay.
Yeah, I can give you your answers.
How much thought did my Instagram? How much thought did draft teachers and those with privileged preferments give to those without such options who were drafted and may have died in their place? What part did cowardice, selfishness, and privilege play among these university students?
In the 60s?
Yes.
Tough question. I think I went down to my draft board and argued with an unbelievable experience, and I got dragged off to the reduction center and stood in a room with naked 18-year-olds. And then they classified me as 1Y. I gave it my best shot. I was willing to go, but I think they classified me as a troublemaker. Do you know what 1Y was?
No.
People that you didn't want until the enemy had actually gotten into American territory, because they were sort of unreliable. I would just put it in an unreliable category. I don't know what would have happened. The people I admire the most are the people who went as soldiers and then rebelled and opposed the war and took that risk. The people I equally admire are the people that went to Canada and took their chances on building a new life, or went to jail, like David Harris, out of a conscientious objection to the system of war. I don't consider it a mortal sin, if you will, for somebody to seek a draft deferment, as long as they're aware that somebody else is going to fill their place. And as long as they devote their time while they're a deferred person, married or university student or what have you, if they devote a significant amount of their time to trying to end the draft or end the war, realizing that they've been given the privilege to do so by this deferment. It's just one of those complex dilemmas, but that's the way I would resolve it. I just was put in 1Y, so I didn't really have to face it. Yes.
I agree with you that I see a diminished capacity of empire over time, and certainly 60,000 lost in Vietnam, 4,000 today, and much rapider movement towards the end of the war than it would have took in the Vietnam War. But the anti-war movement, I just think I agree with you, the successes. On the other hand, so I do see some diminishing there. On the other hand, I do see some strengthening of empire in other levels. And after World War II, we doubled incomes across the board in the next generation. In the generation since then, we've seen no income growth among the bottom 94%, they say, since 2000. It really goes back to the 70s, pretty frozen incomes. And we see the rise of these neocons and this imperial presidency that puts Nixon to shame with the abuses going on. So you see some hardening of the arteries of empire on the other hand. So how do you reconcile these conflicting things?
That's a good point. You don't have to reconcile them. There's several things can go on at once. There's no doubt. Where I think it really comes to a head is when and if they attack Iran. At that point, my model of social change comes to a kind of a crossroads. I think it's scary that I've never met any peace activists who have a plan for what to do the morning after the bombing of Tehran. I think people really need to focus all of their minds on what are you going to do the next day and how is that going to play into the next week and the next week. If it happens, it will happen as part of the election year of 08, of course. It'll be like a Hail Mary pass, and who knows what the political outcome would be. But That's the first point. I would start arguing with people that not that it's a moral or immoral issue, but that it's more of the same, almost insanely risky business, because it allows Iran to respond on day two, and the military does not have a plan for day two. Iran can close the Gulf, Iran can invade eastern and southern Iraq, Iran can attack other parties in the region. We don't have the forces to occupy a second country. An overnight shock and awe attack would set back Iran in terms of its infrastructure for years, but would do nothing to set back Iran from a people standpoint. It would only inflame and trigger a resistance that we probably have no way to handle or predict. So it's the most highly irresponsible behavior imaginable. And this word has to go out in all the ways, on leaflets, religious bodies. People have to be talking about, not, we get into this paranoid argument back and forth. It's going to happen. You know they're going to attack Iran. And speakers are paid fees to go around the country describing how they know on the basis of their sources that we're going to invade Iran. It's almost as if we really want to get this straight for our own mental security and stability. We want to know that they're going to do it to us again. You know, it's the same people that thought the elections were always stolen by Diebold. Now think, this war in Iran has already been cooked up and it's going to happen. They just don't tell us when. So what? The question is, what will you do leading up to it, and what will you do the day after and the day after that? It could very well turn to be a huge folly for the Pentagon and for the White House. That's how I would see it. We have no choice but to see it that way. We have to prepare to oppose the bombing of Iran, but not dwell on it as if we're ignoring everything that's in front of our face, which is the next congressional vote on Iraq with a Q. Let's keep it in order. But I definitely think these issues you're raising would come to the most challenging boiling point if they do go off and start a second front. Yeah.
Apropos of your closing comments about the suffragists, can you address what it would have meant for the anti-war movement and the birth of modern feminism if the males who were leading the radical anti-war movement had been better on gender issues and women's issues?
In the 60s?
In the 60s.
Or in the 10s?
In the 60s.
No, I can't.
Will you please?
I started to think about the arguments, you know, between the socialists and the suffragettes, and I'm there. I don't know the answer to your question. What interests me is how all that incredible, rich dialogue over a 100-year period seemed to evaporate in my time. It was as if there had been no suffrage movement and no argument over how radical it should be and no argument over male show. These arguments were born anew, as it were, in 1964, like out of internal processes in the 60s movements. But in fact, there was a whole rich tradition of this debate and the problem of resolving the debate that we were deprived of. Yeah.
You brought up some great points about the use of the internet in campaigning, MoveOn.org and Howard Dean's campaign and all of that, and the collection of money through the internet. But could you expand a little bit on the internet in various political movements, comparing it to the sit-in, to the kinds of physical movements of the past. I'm a little worried that we're emailing ourselves and feeling like we've done something.
Exactly.
We've got an online petition and maybe do it virtually.
Well, I'm old school. I believe in actually spending a good part of every day talking to people that don't agree with me or know nothing.
I don't even go to bed until I've done that. I don't talk very much to the left of me. I talk to the right of me. That would be my rule. And I think that the problem with the internet is that it can be a substitute for face-to-face human communication. But it's more than just a tool that facilitates, you know, sending out a lot of messages. There's no doubt about it. I'm talking about the photos from Abu Ghraib came from a prison guard who put pictures up on the web, and that drove CBS to cover the story, which they wouldn't have. I'm talking about the fellow that put dozens of pictures of American soldiers in coffins coming back to base in America, which the New York Times wouldn't publish, but suddenly everybody in the country was looking at them. These are the equivalent of Rampart Magazine and the napalm photos in 1966 that so inflamed people in Madison and around the country. So in that sense, even poor Saddam Hussein couldn't be executed without somebody with a cell camera, a cell phone, shooting it. And you get this instant disclosure of a lot of stuff that's irrelevant, but instant disclosure that you never had before that can go around institutions and get straight to people, as well as the ability to build phenomenal lists and to raise money and so on. So it's not like there's even a question about it. I'm pro-internet. Who isn't? But I see the internet bloggers as the vanguard of a multi-sided movement that includes control over the means of communications. But the reason that they're so privatized, it could be problematic, but basically, if you've got drilled into your mind that anti-war movement only comes to life when blood is running down somebody's face at the end of a police club, or a draft card is being lit, okay, then the blogosphere is by definition invisible. So there's nothing dramatic about somebody blogging at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's just a little blue light at the computer screen. Nothing gives. So I think we're somewhat taken in or blinded by the images of our own past experience and don't always see the stuff that's developed. Dean didn't know. Dean, I interviewed Dean for my book, and he said he considered himself to be an instrument of the blogosphere, that when he started, he didn't know what it was exactly, but he could feel that they were using him to create this explosion of energy that was just looking for a specific cause. So all power to them.
You mentioned that Feingold from Wisconsin could vote against the Patriot Act because Wisconsin is not Kansas.
And I said, would he have voted for it if he was from Kansas?
Yes.
I don't know.
You said, right, you phrased it as a question, but then, if I'm not incorrect, you added that you believe in free will, but you also believe that behavior is conditioned by environment, by context. Is that correct?
Yes, I said that. I didn't mean that. I don't think there is any. I don't think there's any such thing as free will. I believe that we feel there's free will.
Right.
It's an experience
right.
We have.
I agree with you. So, given that background, I want to ask you something about radical tradition. Because you are both a
set myself up here.
An activist and a teacher or a scholar of that tradition. Like other nationalities, I suppose Americans from time to time make comparisons between our place, our people, and other peoples. Latin Americans, you mentioned Chile, Europeans, Sweden, Germany, so forth and so on. Who's better, who's worse, etc., etc. My question is the following one. Given that every culture has some kind of a tradition, and every culture has a partly radical tradition within that larger tradition, since you have obvious confidence or faith in American radicals to make reforms, genuine reforms, what you call meaningful reforms. Could you tell me what you believe to be some of the key social factors in America that favor reform? Is that clear enough? That's the best I can frame it.
I'll just give a short answer and I can carry on.
I'd like to hear what you think is peculiar about the American topic.
You'll need a blue book.
No, I think that it's a good question. A quick answer would be that Marxism is European, right? So Marxism derives from the European experience.
Originally.
Yes, including communism, socialism, Trotskyism, even anarchism, which may not be Marxism. They're all European. And they've been internationalized, and where they've had some success, they're kind of like liberation theology. It proceeds from a concept of a center, the Vatican or Moscow, but then it has to be decentered and completely incorporated into the indigenous tradition to a point where it may not even appear to be its original. Like Vietnamese communism and Cuban communism are very different communisms because of those cultures. I didn't come out of that tradition, and I have great fascination with it, and I've learned a lot from it. And in saying it's not an American tradition, I don't mean to fall into the notion that it's a foreign conspiracy or ideology, but it's not a Bolivian tradition either, as Che found out. So I guess I would say the American tradition, to the extent that anything is unique and not borrowed, is the good side of the two-sided nature of the frontier. Is it like an anarchistic individualism that is part of it, and the other part of it is the two-sidedness of the origin story. You know, to overthrow the king and overthrow aristocracy, overthrow privilege, at the same time colonize the continent, and if necessary, brutalize and exterminate the inhabitants. So people can't, there's no way to handle that as one concept. It's the hardest concept about, you know, any country whose founding story is both liberating and genocidal. This is what the fight with the Turks and the Armenians is about. The Turkish people had the Ataturk, the Republic of 1923, which is the central story of the Turkish nation state, occur simultaneous with the genocide or suppression of the Armenians. And so they can't recognize what happened to the Armenians at their hands, because it delegitimizes the story of their state. We can't recognize what we did to the continent and to the people living here, because it delegitimizes the United States of America founding story. So the hardest thing is to come up with the creation story of our country that is true and that we can embrace, because at least half of it is unbearable. It's just unbearable. People can't handle it. They try. They try their best. The apologists say, well, the Indians are better for it. They do. Or take slavery.
Tom, I think
do you know how many people believe that the African Americans are better off as Americans than if they'd been left alone in Africa? That's what people believe. Slavery was a horrible chapter of our development, but aren't these people better off? So that's the big problem, is how to, how to reconcile the creation story of this country in a way that future generations can live with and at the same time is true.
Tom, you said slavery. When I go back to the abolitionist movement, And there have been some comparisons in the anti-war movement and the abolitionist movement. And I think that many of them are accurate. Going back to the question, there is a trend, there's a thread in American history that when Jefferson and Madison had the debate about the procedural republic that we were, that there has always been a thread in American history throughout it of people who literally believe in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. And that's what happened with the abolitionist movement, and we didn't get into this the last two nights, but when people have asked the question, was there something in our generation that was different? One of the things I think that made a difference was that we were raised in the shadow of World War II. Our parents told us why we fought in World War II, and we really believed that it was for justice, that it was for dignity, that it was to stop oppression. And that is part of that tradition, that thread.
I think that was a high point for the American left also, because peculiar circumstances put the Soviet Union and the United States on the same side. Even saying that doesn't excuse Dresden, Hiroshima, and the rest of it. The exhilaration of war and so on. But yes, in the 40s, it was very difficult to get people to hate communism. Aren't those the people that we were just fighting with? Now we're fighting against them. It was a brutal transition to the Cold War, McCarthyism, and so on. I'm apolitical by background. None of this ever affected me, but I would have probably identified very much with the Popular Front.
Yep. We've got about 1 minute or 2 minutes left now.
Are the men going to come? They will.
He will.
This is the business school, too.
Yeah. So?
I'll keep this question under 2 minutes. I can't help but look at the war on Iraq as the largest single event in a larger drama. There is within Islam a movement of fundamentalists that are opposed to American interests. We'll use violence, have at least once attacked this country, apart from the current war. Should that movement be opposed? And if it should be opposed, how?
Right. My perspective is a little different, like having been under many a school desk during the Cold War waiting for the atom bomb to obliterate me. I make a big different distinction between the Soviet Union and the Islamic movement that you describe. The Soviet Union had missiles aimed at Europe and at ourselves. They had missiles in Cuba. We had two occasions where it almost all broke loose, where the two sides had their engines running in Berlin, pointing at each other. And secondly, I was there in Washington when I.F. Stone told us that time had run out on the negotiations, and that at any moment the missiles from Cuba would be fired. Within nanoseconds after that, our missiles would go off. And I was so stunned at this coming apocalypse that I sat down with Dick and Mickey Flex to have a cheeseburger. That's how, like, shock and awe. Yes, I was like completely unable to cope with this. So then the so-called threat, whether it was real or so-called, the threat of the Soviet Union was far greater than any threat from any Islamic movements today. You say, well, they hit us. Well, yeah, and those were painful hits. Those are immoral, they should be condemned. But people went off suddenly saying they put our civilization at risk. 3,000 deaths in New York. I think they should be treated as 3,000 human beings and not stand-ins for civilization. For instance, 50,000 people die in this country every year from tobacco-related exposures, and we don't say our country is at risk from the tobacco industry. So some of it is perceptions.
Your question, though, is how to deal with it. I think you want to go back and try to trace where the violence became directed our way, and see whether those conditions are being perpetuated, or what we can do to mitigate or erase those conditions. I'm talking about American forces and American oil companies in the Middle East, most of all. You know, then we'll see. But in the meantime, I don't know whether all the precautions we take are necessary or they just make us feel good. But I'm certainly glad that precautions are being taken. That if they ever lead to stopping somebody in the midst of a real conspiracy to commit a real act. And I don't think it's just a police problem. I think it's an overall problem of police and military. But basically, what I'm afraid of is that the war on terror, to me, is understood as a substitute for the war, the Cold War. And that it's a new way to galvanize Americans to look at a foreign enemy and to divert resources from our own needs to a buildup, putting more money into the intelligence agencies that failed to predict 9/11. More money into the Pentagon, which has failed in Iraq. More money into failed institutions is not my idea of security. But on it goes. So we're all prisoners of our experience. But that's my experience. And so the people I'm most interested in are the people who stand up and say, the idea of the war on terrorism is wrong. There's no such thing as a terrorist. A terrorist is a tactic. And there's multiple forms of terrorism, and you need to reduce whatever conditions lead people to violence, and then analyze what's left. Do you need further security measures, or don't you? But I think everybody knows now that everything we do in the war on terrorism is creating more terrorists. Everything we do every day in Iraq is creating the things we say we're against. Like, there was no Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia before the American invasion. Now there is. Everybody we take out, there's 10 more are created. Go to a movie like this, Jennifer Garner and...
Jamie Foxx and Kingdom.
Oh my God. You know, four FBI agents dispatched to Saudi Arabia take down the entire apparatus of terrorism that's infecting the kingdom and threatening their lives. This is the worst propaganda since Rambo. So maybe I'm just reacting to that, but I think we've got to get out of the Middle East in terms of oil companies trying to assert dominance, and we've got to get our troops out of the Middle East and Afghanistan, period. Out of Muslim lands. This does not seem like a controversial proposition to me. No country in the world that I know of even imagines the idea of dispatching large numbers of troops to control some other country that is not even at war with. We've got now the Navy is getting into it, you know, they're up in the Gulf, and the Navy wants to now triple its budget in order to bring more supplies to the emergencies that are ahead. The Nagel and these counterinsurgency theoreticians are predicting 50 years in an arc of crisis from Europe to South Asia, in which we have to be deployed in all these countries that nobody's ever heard of. This is a recipe for defeat after defeat after defeat after defeat, the creation of more terrorism, more hostility to the United States. It just has to be ended. And then we'll see. My disagreements with the Muslims you described, that those movements are about women's rights, theocracy, environmentalism, not simply whether civilian casualties are acceptable, but most of the things that I hate about those movements, I disagree with those movements on, cannot be solved by the dispatch of troops. You know, you can't equalize opportunities for women in the Muslim world with, special forces or Jennifer Garner appearing in a movie. and making these guys shake her hand. But that's just my view. My disagreements are not military, or not, they don't lend themselves to military solutions. The military approaches only compound the problems and reinforce the hierarchies. Any last?
We got to close up.
He's coming.
Yeah. He's there.